Welcome to Accounting Marketing Doesn't Suck. Join host Hugh Duffy as he takes you behind the scenes with successful accountants, CPAs, and industry elites in conversations about growing a more profitable business. This podcast is meant to prove that accountant marketing truly does not suck and, in fact, can provide you with new skills to improve your effectiveness so you can learn how to develop a business that you want to run, not a business that's running you.
Hello, and welcome to the Accounting Marketing Doesn't Suck podcast. I'm your host, Hugh Duffy, and on today's show, we'll be talking to Gail Crossley with Crossley & Company, which is a growth consulting firm for large CPA firms. On today's session, we'll focus on niche development and why top-notch firms care about niches. Before introducing Gail, I'd like to share some insights on why our listeners would like to hear about Gail's interesting background and variety of experience. Gail is a practicing CPA. She's licensed in Georgia and Ohio and has worked with Arthur Anderson and PwC. She also has extensive experience working in marketing and business management roles in the technology industry with IBM and MCI. Gail is one of the most recognized growth consultants in our industry. Accounting Today has recognized her as one of the top 100 most influential people in the accounting industry for 13 years. Inside Public Accounting has recognized her as one of the best for 14 years. Gail is on the editorial advisory board for the Journal of Accountancy, and she's helped many of the CPA firms grow onto the top 100 CPA firms list. With that distinguished introduction, let me introduce to you Gail Crossley. Welcome, Gail.
Thank you, Hugh. It's great to be here with you today and your listeners.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. So, in your words, can you paint a picture for our listeners why rapidly growing CPA firms care about niches?
Oh, yes. Back in the day when our firm started, we didn't need to be niche-oriented nor care about them. Because early markets, the hallmark of early markets is they're generalist markets. You hang out your shingle, come one and come all, and there isn't a lot of competition, and you are just starting in the business or the market is just starting up. And so it's a very undefined, ill-defined market, and being a generalist is good enough. There are plenty of fish in the pond. There's not that many competitors. You're new at it yourself. The market is new, and therefore being generalist is the strategic imperative of the day. However, as markets mature out, what happens is competition increases dramatically, and as a result of that, margins thin out. At the same time, revenues, which used to be on a very hockey stick-like growth curve early and in the middle of the life cycle of a market, actually revenues plane out as well. So you've got revenues that are planed out. You've got margins that are at their thinnest point. As a result of that, also, you have enormous competition. And I will tell you that today we have around 660-some thousand CPAs resident in 44,000, give or take, CPA firms. So there's lots of competition. And our core services, audit, accounting services, tax services, look very much this way. They look thin-margined and very commoditized. This is why niches become important, because niches are specialties that are either specialties in a service area and or a buyer group or both. And therefore, in order to distinguish yourself and keep your margins and your pricing as high as possible, the strategic imperative in mature markets is specialization. In other words, it is incongruous to be a generalist in a mature market because you'll get caught in this trap of decreasing, declining margins, profitability, compensation, your own compensation, and so forth. And it's the worst place to be because in mature markets that are now subject to upset and being shaken up, you will, if you're not careful, go the way of the buggy whip. Hmm. So that's why.
I see. So dimensionalize that for us. So a generalist in a large category where business is business might have a margin of what versus a specialist? How much higher would their margin be versus just a general who takes whatever walks in the door?
Oh, it could be exponential. And it depends a lot upon how unique you are in the market. If you, in fact, have found your market hole and you are so unique that there are no others like you, then your margins can be not just incrementally a few percentage points, but exponentially many, many, many percentage points higher than a thin margin generalist who is working on margins that in our profession, I think that, you know, margins in the 20 to 30% range would be pretty natural. If you're a specialist, you can be up in the, you know, 50 to 80% range. You can be very high. And until you lose your uniqueness, and maybe you never will lose your uniqueness, and the smart firms are the ones that stay innovative, competitive, out in front, differentiated, and never have to be in the basement. Now, the other part about that is that although our margins by way of comparison of other industries like grocery chains that are 1% look still pretty good, but we are in a sea storm right now of change in our profession that's going to really hammer our margins because of technology. So we're on a downward curve and have been for several years of a point here, a point there, every year or so of declining margins.
That helps. So generally speaking, then, a specialist, a true specialist, can expect margins that are about twice the size of a generalist, correct?
I would suspect so, yes, if you are unique in your space. And the reason why I say that is the market, if you have established your uniqueness, the market is willing to pay what market rates are. And they're not based upon what your charge hours are or how many hours you put into something. The more forward-thinking firms know this, and they don't even charge by the hour. They charge based upon what the market will bear. And the market will bear whatever it is you've got if you've got something they want. There is really no practical limit to what they will, you know, what they will pay.
I love that. Mm-hmm. So in your eyes, and I'm speaking broadly, what is a niche in the accounting industry?
That's a great question, Hugh. I don't use the word niche. And the reason I don't use the word niche is because it has so much baggage and so much confusion as to what exactly it is. So I'm using it today because that's what people know, but I want you to know that I use the word segment. And what the word segment means is it means a segment of your revenue or a chunk of your revenue of the firm. So it could be a service line segment or it could be an industry segment. But and so when I look at the word niche, some firms refer to a niche as a service line that is unique. Mm-hmm. Others refer to it as an industry, which is unique. And there's no consistency around it, so we'll just use it for anything in your firm that is a chunk of the revenue, either a service or an industry, that you are focusing in on and aspiring to evolving a uniqueness about it.
I like that. So let's give an example. So suppose there's a smaller CPA firm. They're not worried about ever becoming a top 100 firm. What are the inherent benefits of becoming known as a best-in-class provider for this particular segment?
The number one benefit, not only for small practitioners but across the board, is the efficiency and effectiveness with which you can grow and deliver your service, and therefore you can spend the same amount of hours and exponentially drive more revenue, profitability, and earnings.
Explain that. What do you mean by it's more efficient to grow your earnings?
When you know how to grow something and you know how to deliver it such that you are so efficient with it, you have the ability to do more in the same amount of time. And I'll give you an example. I travel pretty much Monday to Friday every week except during tax season when no one wants to see me. By virtue of the fact that I do that, I can pack in about 10 minutes. Now, I'm off the road during tax season quite a bit. I'm still on the road, but not like I usually am. And now, when I'm out of practice with packing, it doesn't take me 5 minutes. It takes me longer than that. And yet, when I hit the road in the spring again, late April, you know, within a few short weeks, I'm back down to my 5 minutes of packing. And I remembered this recently when I was putting on makeup one Friday morning at 8 o'clock in the morning here in Atlanta, and I got a call that caused me to have to get to Boston immediately. And I packed, got a plane ticket, got to the airport, which is 40 miles away, and boarded a plane at 10 o'clock, 2 hours later. That's what I mean by being efficient, because I do it all the time. So the same is true with driving growth. When you become very niche or specialized oriented, you find patterns in the selling process that are unique and specific to that particular thing you're selling, to that particular buyer group you're selling it to, and you can sell much more in the same amount of time than you could otherwise. So you can drive incredible amounts of revenue as a result, that are exponential over, you know, running from one thing to another thing to a third thing and re-remembering how you had done something.
No, I couldn't agree with you more. So in your experience, I mean, you've coached a lot of firms over the years. How long does it take to develop a meaningful traction in a segment, whether it's an industry or whether or not it's a particular specialty?
It takes about 3 years if you are committed to it and do the work necessary to get it off the ground. And if you lay those foundations, then in year three, you'll start to see some traction, and from there, you'll be off to the races, which is why a lot of firms aspire to specialization in a niche, but don't ever make it there because they might be distracted, or it's too hard, or they don't see the immediate benefits, so they throw in the towel, or they don't know how to do it. And so, like anything new, it takes some time. But I must tell you that because I do this for a living, when I started this practice 17 years ago, knowing this was the nature of the beast, I didn't anticipate any revenue in year one. And I was pleasantly surprised that I actually booked $11,700 worth of revenue in year one. And that was after putting in, you know, pretty much 100 hours a week for a year, right? Because it's like a new baby, you know. You bring the new baby home and you're exhausted. I mean, all the time. Year two, my revenues were 10 times what they were in year one. And year three, okay, they doubled again, and then they doubled again. I mean, and I knew that because I had started another company, several years ago, and I thought, oh my gosh, this is unbelievable. Is it ever going to happen? And that first company, it was finally in year three, I started to see results. And, this time it was easier. You know, now I could lop a year off, and this time it only took 2 years. So once you do it, once you know how to grow something, then what happens is you can grow anything. I tell my coachees that, when they retire, if they want to go and start a flower shop, you know, they'll know how to get it off the ground because the principles are the same. I call them generally accepted growth principles, and they're the same regardless of what it is you want to grow.
Mm. So what's the glue that holds one of these segments together? I mean, what's kind of the process that you walk your clients through that helps them start to gain some momentum and some traction at the beginning?
The first thing in larger firms, and I'll talk about larger firms than smaller firms, in larger firms, and I'd say any firm that has, say, four or five or more partners, and that would be firms that would be maybe $5 million a year or more in revenue, it is a shift in mindset from playing golf as individual contributors to playing football as a football team. So the first thing that you do is you get your football team lined up with the leaders and who is going to take what position in the firm. If you're a smaller firm, let's say a sole practitioner such as me, And I use the same principles myself to get my own business off the ground twice. So if you're a smaller firm, anywhere from a sole practitioner, and there are a couple, three of you, then you do the same exact thing, and I'll tell you what that is in a moment, but where you go with it is a little bit different. In both cases, the first step is to do something called revenue segmentation. And I mentioned this earlier on, that these niches are either industry or service line niches, and they're really revenue segments. And some of your revenue segments will be a result of the fact that you had work that you have been doing for years. And so you're already in the market in certain places, and you already have revenues in certain service lines. So picture a great big spreadsheet in the sky, and you take the revenues of the firm, and those are at the lower right-hand corner. Let's say we have a $2 million firm, and we'll put the revenues of $2 million in the lower right-hand corner. And you divide the revenues up between the services that you are providing, and those are your rows, and the buyer groups or industries that you're serving, and those are your columns. And you populate the spreadsheet, and that's called revenue segmentation. It sounds benign and looks benign, but it is so powerful, and it's the foundation of everything that follows from there, because of the fact that you are now seeing where the market has taken you, even if you didn't aspire to go there in particular. And you see concentrations or lack thereof of revenue in these rows and columns. And if you've been a Uber generalist, you could have 6 to 12 columns and probably a half a dozen rows. If you've had some specialization, then perhaps you'll have fewer than that. But it's a visual representation of where you already are. And if you have lots of rows and lots of columns in your $2 million firm, you have seen in full living color, and you've probably already felt it, that you're going from pond to pond to pond to pond. Each of your industries or buyer groups is a pond in and of itself. And so you're going hither and yon, and you're never getting traction in one particular place, which back in the day was okay, because when we had banker breakfast, lawyer lunches, country clubs, client cocktails, referral sources, so forth, that was good enough, because you could get concentrations of buyers in that way, and everybody was equally attractive as a buyer. Well, you can't do that very well in a specialist market, because you go to the country club and there are 10 other CPAs at the country club and there aren't that many buyers. So it's not working like it did back in the day. Our more senior people, they have already built 30 years plus of relationships, and they are, they're okay because they're riding those relationships into the sunset, not the up-and-comers. And if the senior people say, well, just come watch me and do what I do, they're going to be sorely disappointed, the younger people, because in this age of technology-driven relationship development and specialization, it doesn't work that well anymore. But the revenue segmentation is a very important aha moment, and you can even add some rows and columns that have zero revenue. If you think that you need to get into, fill in the blank, just add a row and a column and put zeros there and say, okay, I don't want to forget that although the market hasn't taken me there, these are perhaps rows and columns that we want to aspire to. And when you get into the larger firms, what you do is you identify leaders who own each piece of the revenue. And so Sally owns audit and Joe owns banking. And so the rows and columns have leaders assigned, and those leaders are responsible for each of those chunks of revenue. In smaller firms, you don't have enough leaders to lead all that stuff. And in a sole practitionership like me, I am the leader of all those things. But it does clarify for you how to look at your markets and how to start shaping niches and specialization as a result.
So, Can you provide a couple examples of how CPA firms have developed a niche or an expertise or a segment expertise and how they managed to dominate that particular target audience?
Yes, I have probably one of my favorite examples uses a lot of the principles that I'll describe here, and that is a modest size firm in Birmingham, Alabama. They were about $4 million in annual revenue at the time, which I deal a lot with the high end of the market, large firms, but I also deal with large thinking firms, and this was very much a large thinking firm. They were large in their minds, even though they weren't necessarily largish on paper. And so we did the revenue segmentation, and we identified about six industries that had more concentration than others. And we identified three or four key service lines: audit, tax, accounting services, I think were the three we had at the time. And we had litigation support, that I remember. And then we had dentists, we had wholesale food distribution, and a couple of others. Law firms, I think, was one. Anyway, I was working with all of their row and column leaders. I call them segment leaders. And one of them had the dental niche, and I looked at his dental niche, and he had three dentists in it. So it wasn't particularly a big niche at the time, but and he had a couple of others. So because we had so few partners, I think we had four partners or something, we each of them took a couple of rows and columns and evaluated each, and then we started opting out. As we went out in the market and interviewed people in each of these, we started opting out. But the dental niche was very interesting because we saw great market conditions. The first thing that we did, and I tell all my segment leaders to do this, is we did financial analysis to see if we were making any money in each of these rows and columns. And in the dental niche, we were doing okay, not great. We had a small sample size, though, so that was easy to do. The audit leader was doing his financial analysis, on the other hand, for months on end. Then what happened is we looked at the size of the market. And this is a really, really critical point. You don't want to go into markets, niches, where there are no fish in the pond, or very few. So the number one indicator of good market conditions, and you want markets that have good conditions because you'll grow faster, is how many fish are in the pond. So if we have a pond that has 100 fish, which, by the way, I think we had in wholesale food distribution, and then another pond that has like 1,500 fish, and I don't know what the numbers are, but I'll make the point here, which is the dentists. Well, you would go and you would put your focus and time and energy, all other things being equal, over in the dental space. So we identified that we had enough dentists in Birmingham to make it worthy of further evaluation. And then he went out and did research calls, which is my service mark name for an interview of lots and lots and lots of people in the dental community. And you ask six questions in a research call of interviewees, and this is how you gather all the market intelligence. And as he was asking the six questions and gathering market intelligence, he was finding something very important in your research, and that is your three strategic elements, the three elements of strategy that always, 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 always drive strategy. And if you know what they are, then you'll be looking for them and you will find them. And one of the three elements of strategy is called distribution channels, which is how you and buyers find each other in great quantities. Okay? I don't want you fishing one fish at a time. I want you fishing with a net, a great big net, and pulling in a whole big haul of fish. And so in this case, he interviewed the vice president of sales for the largest distributor of dental equipment and supplies called Henry Schein. There were actually two at the time, Henry Schein and Patterson Dental. And one of the categories of people you interview are other providers of goods and services, because they can give you market intelligence and you will be able to find great quantities of fish through these channels, and other providers is one channel category. So I said, find out, and when I send him out to do research calls, find out what the channel needs. And that's called channel alignment. What does the channel need that you could give to it? And in this way, you're looking for what you can give to a channel and what they can give to you so that you have a symbiotic relationship that you can develop. Now, this is not let's go write an article for them or let's go sponsor a booth. This is way beyond that because it's not tactical, it's strategic, and it's not episodic, it's ongoing. In his first interview with the vice president of sales of Henry Schein, his top question was, what are the issues and the problems that are facing people like you? And he said, well, my top issue is that I always have to sell more equipment. My organization, that's what we do. That's our top issue every year because we start in January 1 with a clean slate, and now we have to make our quota this year and sell more equipment. And so as they were talking, my coachee, my segment leader, said, were you aware of accelerated depreciation on capital equipment? Now, this was a few years ago when we had accelerated depreciation, and the VP of sales said, what is that? I mean, he said, well, if you sell a dentist a $100,000 piece of equipment, he could put up to $25,000 in his pocket in tax savings. And I mean, that just absolutely is a great example. And I have many, many, many of them, of a potential channel alignment because we need to meet more dentists and he needs to sell more dental equipment. So they got their heads together and said, well, what can we do about this? We want to meet more dentists. You want to sell more equipment. I know how to communicate this and motivate your dentist to buy equipment from you. So the VP said, let's get all my sales reps in here. There were about 30 or 40 from all over the Southeast. And why don't you present this tax-saving idea, bring your PowerPoint deck, and let's see if we can't get them educated and motivated to get you out there making, in our sales calls. And that's what happened. So we are now in the dentist's office all over the Southeast, and then not to be outdone, we found two other channels who wouldn't return our phone calls when we wanted the interviews. One was the dental school, another one was the dental society. But when we called for the third time, and oh, by the way, we're working with Henry Schein, and here is the way in which we're working with them, instant callbacks, instant interviews, and found two other channels, alignment with those channels. We met young dentists in the dental school. We met older dentists, more mature dentists in the dental society. We found out there was a dynamic between selling firms, buying firms. We launched an M&A service to help the young ones buy the dental practices from the old one. We helped both our channels. It was just a case study in wonderfulness around how this methodology of specialization in a niche can work.
That's fascinating. So can you provide an example of where a CPA firm had a vibrant, I'm going to call it segment, and how another firm was able to take that particular segment away from them?
Oh, yes. I've got this one comes out of New Jersey. There was a firm up in the New York, New Jersey area that owned a market, and it was the technology company market. And they had that strength in that market for years. My client, my coachee, walked in the door one day and said, I don't know how we can unseat this other firm. They've been out here. They're everywhere. They're at cocktail parties. They're everywhere, everywhere, everywhere. And I said, don't be concerned. There's always a market hole. We just have to find it. And a market hole is a place where your competition isn't. And when you're looking for a market hole, then you will purposefully have your eyes and ears open and your radar up to find the hole, and it will reveal itself. I said, go and do your research calls on as many people in this segment, in these four categories that I teach, that will help you figure out what the top issue is in the segment. And the top issue in that segment was that the programmers that were coming out of the technical schools were learning a programming language that the technology companies did not need nor want. And I believe, and I don't know exactly what it was, but I think the tech companies wanted Ruby on Rails programmers, and the technical schools were graduating others, other than Ruby on Rails. So my coachee took that issue, and I said, you're going to own that issue. And he said, but that has nothing to do with accounting. And I said, it doesn't matter. Yeah, it doesn't matter. This is what they care about. And if you want to go deep into their pond and understand them, then you're going to care about that issue, and you're going to own it, and you're going to sponsor it, and you're going to have a bright, shiny light on it, and you're going to get all the resources involved, you know, in figuring out who cares about it with you. So go and talk to people who care about the issue. And he did. He found two or three channels that cared very deeply about the issue. Not the least of which, and this should be, you know, obvious when I say it, of course the universities are going to care about the issue. So he cooked up an idea with the trade association who cared about the issue, that what he would do with the trade association is hold an event, co-sponsor an event, and he would facilitate a panel of university professors around the issue, where the audience of CEOs of tech companies could, in fact, ask ask the panelist about, you know, why don't we have Ruby on Rails people coming out of here, and what are you going to do about it, and all that. So they threw this event and had about 100 executives come, and there he was, as the moderator of the panel, owning the issue, promoting the issue, you know, understanding of the issue, and it was wonderful. And they announced they were going to do a Survey Monkey survey after the event, and then have another event and give everybody the results, which they did. And this time, they had double the number or more of people in the audience. A lot of buzz around the event. The newspaper, the local newspaper, showed up because Governor Chris Christie at the time was very interested in jobs in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And anyway, the rest is pretty much history. It was just absolutely, he started to cultivate his channels, the relationships, what the channels needed, how the channels wanted to help their members, how his objective was to be front and center in his pond. I call it the pond or the ecosystem or the market. They're all three the same thing, AKA. And that's how now, here years later, he's one of the top growing niches in his firm, and that competitor is no longer the big fish in the pond.
That's fabulous. So what segments do you feel are currently underserved in the marketplace?
Right now, the ones that are underserved are it's really the service lines that are now underserved because of where we are at a moment in time and the pairing between the service lines and the industry. So I'm going to start with the service lines, and they are the service lines that are going to be needed around data analytics, consulting, artificial intelligence consulting, cryptocurrency consulting. Those are the three right now that are, and even consulting in the robotic process automation area, but that right now will probably, all of these are going to start within our firms using these services for ourselves and then morphing them into the market. So you can't get there fast enough. And when you look at, let's just take one of these, data analytics, which is a starting spot for a lot of firms. Now we get into the rows and the columns, and think about, you have a row called data analytics consulting, and you have zero revenues in it right now in your revenue segmentation, and you have all these columns that are maybe half a dozen industries. Now you go out and you make research calls in each of the half a dozen industries and find out which ones are the ones where data analytics is taking root, and which use cases are they taking root in. And those are the ones that are underserved right now by our profession. Mm-hmm. They may be served by other professions because data analytics is out there already with with consultants. But in our profession, we've got uniquenesses around the fact that we already have access and visibility to the data itself. And I'll give you a perfect example right now in one of my firms where we went out and made research calls and found out that in the local government space, that data analytics could be used for that is the service, data analytics consulting, and the buyer group, the column is local government, in the procurement departments for waste and fraud detection and remediation. And so now, and this is a firm that has many rows and columns, but that one is proving to be one where we've made the research calls and found the use case, and now we are looking for early adopters among local governments that would jump in to projects with us to help us shape and mold the consulting services. Meanwhile, by the way, we had to go get ourselves ready to actually do consulting and data analytics. So we're working on both sides of it at the same time, and we found an external resource that we can partner with. So we don't have any capability yet in-house, but we are going to, you know, developing through our early projects capability in-house. And the nice thing about this story is that you can see, even if you're a small practitioner, how you would find your market, and how you would find your resources, and how you would do this incrementally with not a lot of cash out of pocket and investment, but incremental investment. Incremental investment to prove out that this was the best market, to prove out that this was the best service, and to figure out through, and we did a lot of research to find consultants and other resources, partnering with someone and not having to go and buy a full-time data scientist resource when you don't even have your first client. Mm-hmm. So this is the beer budget, but also recommended way to do this, the incremental way to do it.
And what about the other side? Are there particular industries that you see are underserved?
Right now, the one that is really coming on strong and will be underserved is cannabis. Of course, it's got a lot of baggage associated with it, so and a lot of complexity, because it's not federally legal yet. And or ever, for that matter, I don't know. But the other one is, it's not underserved, but it's going to be soon, and that's cryptocurrency and or blockchain-related industries, especially in the distribution space with large distribution companies who are going to be creating private blockchains, and their suppliers are going to be required to or will want to participate in their private blockchains, and so they're going to need to have accountants who can do the accounting for blockchain and the auditing of blockchain. Those are probably the two right now that look to be where I look for underserved. It's not necessarily underserved today, because if it's underserved today, you're too late. But the ones that are, you know, that are going to be underserved in the not too distant future, because you can see the tremendous hockey stick demand that's going to be out there, and the early to market firms are the ones who are hooking into this.
And in your experience, are there top 100 firms out there willing to pay a premium for somebody that has an expertise in a particular service line or in a particular industry?
Absolutely. And in fact, two areas today that have been, you know, really on a very a steep growth curve over the last few years have been client accounting services and international. And the fascinating thing about these two are that many firms are starting their client accounting services, or they're in them already because they've been doing it for many years. And if they did their revenue segmentation, they would see client accounting services that they're doing across the board for a lot of industries. But the reality is that if you pivot into and you start, letting go of those industries that you don't need to be serving, and you find out that the industry that you should be serving with the best market conditions is over here, that you invest over there, you're going to grow faster in these fast-growing segments, and you're going to wake up one day, and if you, in fact, have a strategy of being acquired in the future, the multiple is going to be much higher than if you're a generalist, because generalists are, they're sort of a dime a dozen, and you're always looking for, you always want to be unique. I have a little story about that that I learned when I was 16 years old, by the way, and I always remember that learning moment at 16 years old about the value of being unique and the fact that as a result, you will be the one that will be picked out of your peers.
So do you expect the top 100 CPA firms to pay a higher premium for a CPA firm that has a strong regional or a strong cannabis niche, given the fact that federally they're just not that interesting to a large firm?
I don't know that I see this today. And the reason why is because the firms that are going to, that are in cannabis right now, if they get it right, they're not going to want to sell themselves because they're going to be making so much money and have so much independence that I don't know that they're going to actually be available for sale. I mean, there is so much demand for services. I mean, and I'll just talk about one of the three buyer groups, and that is the state and local government buyer group. I mean, this buyer group, think about it. California, dozens of cities and counties that have to implement and make sure that they have auditing staffs in place to drive compliance throughout the state. I mean, think about it. I mean, and if you're in the state and local government area already, my gosh, you know, it could be. I'm not saying that it would be, but it could be, for example, an area of high growth for you. So I don't know what the future will hold for that. But and the other part of it is because, you know, just from a moral, ethical, and philosophical standpoint, I think we'll live in a conundrum for quite a while. We will live for quite a while. So it's going to be a very challenging many years for that particular segment.
There is baggage. There's no doubt about it. And it's very hard to kind of hang your hat on a particular area that has some baggage to it. So yes, it kind of still is your brand name, your equity that you've built over many years, and lots of trust. So that one's hard.
Well, and we're all wired in a certain way to either believe that this cannabis thing is an okay or good thing, or believe that it is a very bad thing. I mean, I grew up, you know, in an era where it was a bad thing. It was a very dangerous thing, and it was a very bad thing. And, you know, and that whole gateway conversation also, you've got all kinds of generations that, you know, have points of view and all that. So it's all in there, and that's why it's a complex segment. Yeah,
no, it absolutely is. Gail, I'd like to thank you for openly sharing your story, sharing your knowledge, your insight, your experience with us. For those interested in learning more about Gail and her business, I encourage you to visit CrosleyCompany.com. Let me spell it for you, www.CrosleyCompany.com. Thanks, everyone. I appreciate it. Hopefully you have a great day, and listen to our next broadcast. Thank you.
Thank you, Hugh, and thank you, audience. Enjoy.